And we are on the Sermon on the Mount, lesson number 2. And so open your Bibles this evening to the book of Matthew chapter 5. And although we will not be doing a lot of reading from there, we'll be looking at some different passages and different places a little bit. But that's the text that we will be beginning with. It's good to see all of you. You probably know from talking to others that Bill is back in the hospital. He had infection in the area of his back where the stitches came together back there. What's that? His incision. That's the word I was looking for, his incision. At the very bottom of his incision, at the very bottom, he's got an infection. And they're going to have to go in and clean it out. He is diabetic, and so he doesn't heal as quickly and as well because of that. And so Friday they will go in and they will do surgery to clean that out good. Then they're going to have to leave it open, kind of open for a day or two, Bonnie tells me, to make sure it heals good before they close it up. So he'll have 2 surgeries, 1 to clean it out and then 1 to close it up. Is that right, basically?
Well, if all goes well, they say they may have to go in more than once to clean it.
Yeah. Yeah, so if they don't get all the infection, or if the infection kind of comes back, I guess it's kind of like a cavity. If you don't get all of it, it'll just keep. So anyway, that he's back at the hospital in Tampa. He's back at the VA in Tampa. So keep him in your prayers. On a brighter side, on a good news note, we have our second intern on board for this fall. We had talked about having 2 in our men's meeting. And so we have come to an agreement. The negotiations on price were long and difficult, but we got him on board. I'm just kidding. I didn't even talk to him about that. So we have Noah Works from New York, and now we have Joshua Brown from Owensboro, Kentucky. They're both Florida College students, both planning to preach the gospel someday, so we're very excited about that. I have known both families for a long time. They were kind of, when I found out that the Browns and the Works had sons in school, they were first on my list because their fathers I've known a long time and their mothers, and they are just wonderful, wonderful people, good workers in the kingdom. They come from good families. And so I'm just very pleased that they're going to be with us. And so we look forward to that. They'll just be a few weeks. In fact, they'll be back. I'll be leaving tomorrow for Vermont, and then I'll get back 2 weeks from now from Vermont, and then they will be here that week. They will be on the campus that week. Now, I'm not sure exactly when they'll start coming over. I told them that they're super busy that first Sunday with activities and things on the campus, that they didn't have to come the first Sunday if they didn't, but I haven't talked to them about exactly that. But anyway, it'll be soon. Okay, so we're in the Sermon on the Mount. Let me just do a quick review, and I want to talk a little bit about the Beatitudes in general, a couple things about that, before we get into our lesson itself. And so last week we talked about an introduction to the book of Matthew, and we think the background and introduction is important because this passage is so important to the connecting it to the whole book. We talked about Matthew being the gospel of the kingdom of heaven, the gospel of the king, the Jewish gospel, the gospel of messianic prophecy, and the gospel of the Son of Man. All those topics, all those themes are important to the book of Matthew. And then we talked about the Sermon on the Mount generally. And as we talked about the Sermon on the Mount, we said that this was the Magna Carta. This was the manifesto, as Paul Earnhardt puts it. The basic principles, the basic teachings about the kingdom of Jesus Christ. This is not just a scattered bunch of teaching. This is not just like the book of Proverbs, and the book of Proverbs is wonderful, but the book of Proverbs, you know, you have, especially from chapter 10 to the end of the book, you have a proverb about this subject and a proverb about that. A lot of them are just one sentence long, and there doesn't seem to be any exact organization to it as far as thematically, but that's not what this is. This is not just some thrown together teaching. As we will study, as we will see, as we examine these three chapters carefully, this is a beautiful sermon outlining the true righteousness that we must have if we're going to be kingdom citizens. And so it's been called the proclamation of the king, or the sermon of true righteousness, the Magna Carta of the kingdom of heaven, a manifesto of the kingdom of God. And we talked last week about Stotts, the title of his book and his idea that he refers to Christian counterculture. God wants us to be different. Christ wants us to be different. We're different from the world. We're not to be like the world. We are to be out of the world, in the world, but not of the world. Come out from among them and be ye separate, Paul writes in 2 Corinthians. And so we should be separate from the world. Just as Israel was called out of the world, we're called out of the world. And so Stott points out that this is the manifesto. This is the basic teaching that calls us to be different. We're not like the world. And this sermon outlines that we're not like the world. Now this evening, I want to begin by talking a little bit about the Beatitudes generally. The first verses from verse 3, after we see in verses 1 and 2 of this chapter that seeing the multitudes, it says, he went up into the mountain, and when he had sat down, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, saying. And so he begins this sermon. The first two verses says he goes up into the mountain. And then if you go to the very end of the sermon in chapter 7, verse 28, and it came to pass when he had finished these words. And so everything in between is the sermon that Jesus preaches. When he had finished these words, the multitudes were astonished at his teaching. For he taught them as one having authority and not as the scribes. And when he came down from the mountain, the multitudes followed. So he goes up into the mountain and he teaches. They're astonished. Then he comes down out of the mountain. So this is a three chapters as a whole, a unit together, the sermon that he preached on this occasion. And so he begins, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. And he goes on. And so each one of these verses begins with this word blessed, 3 through 12. Blessed, and each one of those, 3 through 9, it's one verse for one blessed. And then in verse 10, 11, and 12, we have three blesseds on the same subject. Three verses all on the subject of persecution that we'll get to, and the eighth. But so there are eight Beatitudes: the poor in spirit, the mourners, the meek, the hungers and thirsters, those who are merciful, pure in heart, peacemakers, and those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. And so we see the eight Beatitudes. The people described, I took this outline from Stott's outline of this material. He said Jesus is describing the kind of people who will be citizens in the kingdom of heaven. He begins the Sermon on the Mount talking about kingdom citizens, the character of kingdom citizens, what we are to be like if we are going to be kingdom citizens. He is not describing eight different kinds of people. And he's not saying that one of you can be poor in spirit and one of you can be meek and one of you can be hungering and thirsting for righteousness and one of you can... No, these are not eight different people or eight different characteristics that somehow all together we can share. But he's talking about eight characteristics that we should have, all of us should have, as citizens, attitudes, characteristics that we should have as citizens within his kingdom. And so Jesus is describing eight qualities that every kingdom citizen should have. He's not describing just an elite group. He's not saying that the best of the best will have these qualities. He's not saying the very spiritually mature will have these qualities. The very saintly will have these qualities. These are qualities that we should all have, that we should all be growing in. So the Beatitudes are Christ's own specification of what every Christian ought to be. All these qualities are to characterize all of his followers. Stott, page 31. And we should grow in these, just like in Galatians chapter 5, when it talks about the fruit of the Spirit. The fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and long-suffering and kindness and goodness and all those things. And so, once again, we're to grow in all those things. We're to develop in all those things, not just one or two of them. And we can't fulfill that commandment by each of us kind of taking one and working on that. We're all to work on those things which he describes here. And so the qualities described are spiritual in nature. What we mean in this section, we're emphasizing that these qualities, these eight beatitudes, are spiritual in nature. They're not physical in nature. Some have struggled, especially because of the way Luke records them. We made a note about this in our lesson this evening. Because Luke says, "Blessed are the poor, for theirs is the kingdom of God." He doesn't say poor in spirit, just blessed are the poor. And he says, "Woe to the rich." And so because of the way he phrases that, some have suggested, well, Stott points out what some have said, and here is the quote from page 31 of his material. Some have argued that Luke's version is the true one. He's saying that some have said that Luke wrote his first, and then Matthew borrowed from his and spiritualized it. So he says, some have argued that Luke's version was the true one, that Jesus was making a social or sociological judgment about the poor and the hungry, that he was promising the undernourished food and the proletariat riches in the kingdom of God, and that Matthew spiritualized what was originally material pledges. But this is an impossible interpretation, he says. And so, again, some have thought that because of Luke's writing, but as we compare them together, it becomes very clear. And as we look at New Testament teaching generally, Jesus is not concerned about the physical. And he's not promising physical blessings for physical people with houses and riches and wealth in this life. He's talking about spiritual qualities. He's talking about the fact that he wants us to have the kind of hearts that will be worthy of kingdom citizenship. And so we know that for lots of reasons. Jesus did not come, we know, to establish a physical kingdom, but a spiritual. And so we notice that when the people wanted to come and make him king in John chapter 6, he refused. He had given them bread. He had made them bread. He had fed 5,000 with loaves and fishes. And the next day they came and tried to compel him to be king, chapter 6, verse 15. And Jesus wouldn't let him. Why? He's not that kind of king. Oh, he'd have made a great king. You just think about that. We'll never have to work again. That's what they were thinking. And this guy would be a great king. He could just feed us. We'll never have to work again. Put down that plow. Put down that hoe. He's just going to feed us with bread from heaven. Great king. But Jesus, of course, was not that kind of king. When Pilate asked him about his kingdom, Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world." "Are you a king then?" Jesus said, "Thou sayest, you have said correctly that I'm a king. To this end I was born, and to this end I came into the world, that I would bear witness to the truth. My kingdom is not of this world." And so, we know, we understand, this audience understands, that this is a spiritual kingdom and spiritual promises, and not a physical kingdom. Therefore, his kingdom and the qualities, both his kingdom and the qualities of his citizens, are spiritual and not physical in nature. Does that make sense? You understand? And so his kingdom is spiritual, and the qualities that he wants of his citizens is spiritual. It's not the wealthy. He doesn't want your money. It's not the most educated. He doesn't want your expertise in whatever area you have studied. What does he want? He wants your heart. He wants your heart. That's what he wants. He wants our hearts. Okay, let me hesitate there for a minute. I got one other section before we go to tonight's questions and tonight's outline. But before I do that, any thoughts about any of that before I go on? Brent looks like he's digging for something there. Are you looking for something in particular?
I'm looking for the presence that be not many of the rich.
That said what?
I think it said be not many of you rich.
Oh, yeah. I'm not sure about 1 Corinthians chapter. I was thinking in connection with that, 1 Corinthians 1, where he says, verse 26, for behold, your calling, brethren, that not many wise after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God chose the foolish things of the world, etc. That was one area I was thinking about. That verse is, I don't know that it says the word rich there, but it's kind of that idea. Is that what you were thinking about?
I didn't think, but that's
okay.
Same idea.
Yeah.
I like what Isaiah 66:2. When my hand made all these things, all these things came into being, spared the Lord. But to this one I will look.
Yeah.
To him who is humble and contrite in spirit.
Yes, yes, and that's exactly the idea, and Jesus quotes that, and I think we have that later in our outline somewhere, but that's a very good to go along with it. Well, let's notice very quickly the blessings that are promised. Jesus uses this word blessed. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Blessed are they that mourn. Blessed are the meek. The word makarios or makarios in the Greek is translated or can be translated happy. But we need to be careful if we wish to translate the word happy. Some have translated it that way, and that's an okay translation if we understand. But often when we think of happiness, we think of having fun and joy and laughter and pleasure. And certainly there's going to be joy and laughter and pleasure as we live in this life and we appreciate the values, I mean, appreciate the blessings that God has given to us and enjoy those things. But that's not basically the idea that if we are citizens of his kingdom, we're always going to be happy like we're at a party. That's not the idea. The happiness that feels that all is well in the world round about me. This is not the meaning that Jesus intended by the word. But Stott says, nevertheless, it is seriously misleading to render makarios as happy. For happiness is a subjective state, whereas Jesus is making an objective judgment about these people. He is declaring not what they feel like happy, but what God thinks of them and what on that account they are. They are blessed. So blessed, blessed, the blessings of God rest upon those who are these kind of people. And we won't always be happy, but we can be blessed. He says, blessed are the poor in spirit, and blessed are those who mourn, and blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth, and all those things. Well, to those people, sometimes sorrows are going to come, and we're going to have the death of loved ones, and we're going to have children that get in some kind of trouble with the law and we have to deal with that, or we make a bad business investment and we lose a bunch of money. And those things don't make us happy as far as this world's concerned. It sometimes causes us to struggle and have to work a little harder, but we can still be blessed. We can still be happy in the way that this passage is talking about, because this is a happiness, this is a joy in Christ, we understand, a happiness and a joy and a contentment that is beyond the things of this world. And so blessed are these people with spiritual blessings that Christ has promised to his kingdom citizens. As these people are blessed, what is the blessing under consideration? The answer is given at the end of each of the Beatitudes. Theirs is the kingdom of heaven. They shall be comforted. They shall inherit the earth. They shall be filled. Oftentimes, that the promise is connected, of course, thematically with what the blessing is. You see a direct correlation between the blessing and the promise. For instance, what I mean by that, blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. A direct connection in the wording. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Sometimes the correlation between the blessing and the conclusion is not necessarily quite as obvious to us. But the point is, all of these are pointing to the wonderful spiritual blessings and the fulfillment that God, the spiritual blessings that God has promised for his people. And I think that's it. So, those are the notes I have before we get to our notes. So let's go to our notes now and our lesson tonight. But again, I took up some time with that, but I wanted to say those general things from Brother Earnhardt and from Stott's outline to help us to understand before we get into the particulars, the details of some of these Beatitudes. Tonight's Beatitude: blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. And certainly the first part of it, this we've already emphasized or talked about, and that is, it's a spiritual blessing. It's not talking about material things. Under one, be there, I asked, can you think of other passages? I gave you a couple of passages that warn us about loving material things. We talk about this a lot. I don't think we need to dwell here. But I asked the question, can you think of other passages? Did you write down some other passages which warn about our attitudes towards the material things of this world? We gave you Luke chapter 12, where Jesus said, beware of covetousness. And Luke 18, it's easier for a camel to go through an eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. Did you think of any others? Bonnie?
1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 17, charge those who are rich in the present age that they not be arrogant nor set their hopes on the uncertainty of riches, but on the living God who richly provides.
Good, good. Don't be arrogant, but set your hope on the uncertainty of riches. Why? Why shouldn't we set our hope on the uncertainty of riches? Because they're uncertain. They're uncertain. Okay, good. Others have a passage or a thought? I jotted down Matthew 6:24. You cannot serve God and mammon. Bonnie?
Proverbs chapter 11, verse 26 and verse 28. 26 is a little bit, it says basically, he who withholds grain, the people shall curse him.
Yes.
And 28 says, he that trusts in riches shall fail, but the righteous shall flourish.
Okay. Good. Very good. Good. I also wrote down Matthew 6:19, do not lay up treasures upon the earth where moth and rust destroy, where thieves break through and steal. Lay up treasures in heaven. Okay? Okay.
Hebrews 13:5. Keep your life free from love of money and be content with what you have.
Be content with what you have. Good. Okay, so many, Pat, can you, number C, or letter C, can you think of some examples of those who are rich toward God and rich in material things? Becky?
Abraham
is one.
Job
was one.
David
was one.
Solomon
was,
yeah,
I guess. Solomon started out well, was rich and rich toward God. He faltered in life, but
Boaz,
good. Boaz and Ruth. I was just studying that story with my Chinese brothers and sisters.
Lydia and Dorcas
had at least some things.
Nehemiah.
Nehemiah was had a high position and we're not told a lot about his wealth, but we can assume a lot about it.
Used some of his own money
for what he was doing. That's right. That's good. Becky?
Well, I had actually Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, because God really blessed,
yes,
all of them. And then I also thought Barnabas. Yeah. And maybe the fact that he just had the wherewithal to sell a field. But anyway.
Well, he may not have had anything left after he sold that field, but it shows his heart. He did have a field. He owned property. He was willing to sell it. Somebody mentioned Cornelius. I didn't think about Cornelius, but Cornelius would have been a wealthy man, most likely. being a centurion like it was, and having servants and all that. So there, and Philemon's a good example too. Joseph of Arimathea is good, and Nicodemus. Aquila and Priscilla may have. We don't know how much they had, but they were generous with what they did have. Okay, letter D. Is being poor materially mean one is automatically rich toward God? No. No, we understand that. And so about the rich and the poor, we can learn several things. The rich have a special challenge, don't they? Why do the rich have special challenges? Even though we have many examples of rich, like Abraham and Job and all those you listed, of being rich but also being rich towards God, why do the rich have a special challenge? Ron?
But most of them think that he did it on their own and don't give God any credit at all.
Okay, and so they forget God. Just like Jesus told the parable about the man who had the great barns. And he said, soul, I have much goods laid up for many years. Eat, drink, and be merry. And he forgot God. And that is a very common problem for the rich, isn't it? Good.
The tendency of rich in general is to trust in the riches.
Yes.
And that's a real problem.
Yes. And that can be our problem, too. I mean, we're rich compared to so many in the world. And so we if we're going to have a problem, it's going to be on that side, I'm afraid. The poor, on the other hand, just being poor, and so the problem with the rich, the tendency of the rich, on the poor side, being poor doesn't necessarily make you righteous. But we often see that the gospel the poor tend to be more receptive to the gospel than the rich. Why is that, do you think? Because maybe they don't trust in those things and they're more humble and they have some characteristics about them that make them more receptive to realizing they need God. They're poor in the things of this world, and their living on the edge has caused them to have this need for something to grab onto. And so Mark 12 says the common people heard him gladly. Okay. Well, let's go on to number two. I said it's my conviction that Brother Earnhardt and John Stott are correct in their understanding. Earnhardt wrote, it's not impossible for the poor to be arrogant or for the rich to be humble. These poor are those who, possessing little or much, have a sense of their own spiritual destitution. Now, this gets to the heart of what it means to be poor in spirit. So when we talk about the one who is poor in spirit, we're not talking about them being poor in poverty. This word poor means destitute. This word poor means beggarly. Earnhardt mentions that in this next paragraph. He says under letter B, the Greek word here translated poor comes from a root word which means to crouch or to cringe. It refers not simply to those for whom life is a struggle, but to men who are reduced to the most abject begging because they have absolutely nothing. The Luke passage is a reference to Lazarus, the poor beggar that was begging for bread and begging for crumbs from the rich man. He's begging. This is the word beg that is used in the same word that's used here of poor. Beggarly, having nothing, being destitute. Again, not physically. Brother Earnhardt goes on to say, here it is applied to the sinful emptiness of an absolute spiritual bankruptcy in which a person is compelled to plead for that which he is powerless to obtain, Jeremiah 10:23, and to which he has no right, but without which he cannot live. And so, Brother Earnhardt is saying, the poor in spirit are those who recognize, we're all at one level, and understand this difference, we are all poor in spirit, in the sense that we are all spiritually destitute. We are all sinners. We are all in the need of the grace of God. But some don't recognize it. Some won't admit it. The poor in spirit are those who are admitting it. the poor in spirit are those who see it. Even though we're all destitute before God and cannot save ourselves and are lost in sin, he's not talking about everyone. He's talking about a certain individual. And the individual he's talking about are those who recognize. That's why we put the word recognize, and Brother Arnhart puts recognize in there. Those who recognize their spiritual destitution, who recognize how weak they are, who recognize that they are sinners and without God's grace they are nothing. And so Stott says, thus, to be poor in spirit is to acknowledge our spiritual poverty, indeed our spiritual bankruptcy before God. For we are sinners under the holy wrath of God and deserving nothing but the judgment of God. We have nothing to offer, nothing to plead, nothing by which to buy favor from heaven. And so being poor in spirit is recognizing that we are sinners. Not just that we are sinners. And now this is closely connected to next week's lesson, or next time's lesson, 2 weeks from tonight. Those who mourn. Those who are poor in spirit should automatically mourn, but they don't always. You could, I suppose, recognize your poverty, but not take the next step and mourn over it. Be sorry about it, really, truly sorry about it. But these are those who recognize their sinfulness, recognize their poverty, their spiritual bankruptcy before God. So question for you that I didn't put in the lesson, but question. What all is involved in being spiritually destitute? What all, and I don't necessarily expect you to answer off the top of your head. I thought about this. What involves spiritually destitute? I've already mentioned some things in those definitions I just read from Earnhardt and Stott, but this is how I answered it. What is involved in being spiritually destitute? One, recognizing that I'm a sinner. Two, recognizing that sin separates me from God. I'm lost. Three, recognizing I am deserving of punishment, and without forgiveness, I will be lost eternally. Four, I have nothing to offer. I have no hope, and therefore I am reduced spiritually to begging God for forgiveness. That's the poor in spirit, I think. Is the highlights of that's the poor in spirit. They're sinners and they recognize it. They really feel the crushing weight on their hearts that they are lost and separated from God, that they are bound for hell, and that there's nothing they can do. I have some change in my pocket. They don't have that spiritually. They don't have a single red cent to offer God. They have nothing. We have nothing. It's by his grace. And so they get to that point that they understand that, and that should lead them to the next step of mourning, crying about it. Ron.
You mentioned earlier that you can't, and we have to realize that we can't save ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's part of that, isn't it? That's all a part of that idea of being spiritually destitute. I cannot save myself. Thoughts, brother? Thoughts? Anything? Becky?
It kind of brought me back to...
I'm putting my money back in my pocket.
You were Chuck that was talking about the percentage of people that don't believe in hell.
Yeah.
So if you don't believe in hell, how are you going to feel that you need to be saved? What do you need to be saved from?
Yeah, yeah.
So...
what's the worst that can happen? If there is no hell, what's the worst that can happen? I can just be like a Rover. I can just be dead all over, as my daddy used to say, just like the dog Rover, dead all over. And when I die, and so no heaven, no hell, no nothing, I'm just off the hook. Yeah, I think that's right. Other thoughts? Oh, Rodney.
A lot of people that are rich, they'll actually crush poor people's souls to where they just drop their head and won't even look up or anything and be so mean and hateful because they got money and think that they can treat anybody like they want to.
Yeah.
because nobody's going to do nothing for them because they have money.
Yeah.
To me, that's the most beautiful thing
yeah.
I see. And I say something. I know the people.
Yeah.
And I will say something.
Yeah.
Because they have no right. Man may not have riches or nothing else. But he's got a soul. And the main thing, a human being has pride.
Yeah.
And you do not take that from a human being.
Yeah.
And they do it all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes that physical riches brings about an arrogance. You know, well, different things can bring about arrogance, but you know, it's kind of like the rich man. He's made it rich, and so he thinks he's so smart, and so it builds up his arrogance, and he thinks he can do just about anything. It's kind of like some of these Hollywood actresses. They've made a lot of money, and they just think they're so wonderful, and they give their opinions about all this stuff like they know anything. You know, I want to say to them, just close your mouths and stop giving your political opinions. I mean, just because you're an actress or an actor doesn't mean you're smart about anything else. You know, just do. Anyway. Okay, two examples. Let's go to, I don't want to carry the lesson over. You can finish it up. That's the main idea that I wanted to hit. Now, lesson four, question four and question five. The individual who feels this spiritual destitution will feel a desperation for God's mercy. And I gave some examples of those who felt desperate. And that's the purpose of this section. In Matthew chapter 15, we see the woman that was desperate for Jesus' help. This was not desperate in the spiritual sense, but in the physical sense. She was desperate for help. It's illustrating being desperate. Her daughter had a demon, and she was a Canaanite. She was not Jewish. And she was so desperate for help, she came to Jesus, and Jesus kind of insulted her, we might say. I don't think he really did, but he said something that might have been insulting. Did she let his insult keep her from begging? She begged him. Even the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the table. Right? I mean, she humbled herself and was begging. Why? Why did she do that? He was the only answer. She humbled herself and begged because he was the only answer.
And she had faith.
She had faith. In Mark chapter 2, we see four men who carried their friend up on a roof and broke a hole in the roof and let Jesus down to him. Why did they do that? That's desperate. Why did they do that? Jesus is the only way. They had to do what they could to get to Jesus. They were desperate. In Luke chapter 7, we see the story in the Simon the Pharisee's house and the sinful woman and we'll talk about this one more next time too, because it does bleed over to being sorrowful because she's crying. Why? She recognizes she needs him. Here's all these rich people sitting around, and she comes in and does that and is crying and washing his feet with her hair. How humiliating is that? Does she care about being humiliated? No. Why? She was desperate for help because she recognized her sins. This is a sense of spiritual desperation. Okay, number five, two examples of those who are poor in spirit. One is David, and we may talk about him more next time. And, of course, his sin with Bathsheba. And then read Psalm 51. It's a wonderful psalm. We'll spend more time with it next time. Psalm 51 and his psalm that shows his heart and how that he was on hands and knees begging God to take him back. And then the Pharisee and the publican. And so we see the publican and how in Luke chapter 18. And what did the publican do? How was he different than the Pharisee? Well, we know the Pharisee was bragging about himself, but the publican, this the opposite. Standing afar off, three things. He stood afar off, didn't even want to come up close. He's like you brethren that sit on the back row. You don't want to get close to me. So he stands afar off. I'm just joking. I'm having fun with you. It's afar off, would not lift up his eyes to heaven, and smote himself on the breast. Why did he do those things? Be merciful to me, sinner. He felt unworthy, totally unworthy. And so a sign of desperation.
Wilson,